UFRadio.me, underground and over the top radio.
Things won't help you at all. What's it gonna be? What's it gonna be, my friend? What's it gonna be? What's it gonna be, my friend? You need more than all the money. What if a man gains the whole world and he ends up losing his whole soul? What's it gonna be? What's it gonna be, my friend? What's it gonna be? What's it gonna be?
This is Jeff Overture from WTFRadio.me. I'm sitting here talking to Jeff Smith. How you doing today, Jeff?
Great, Jeff. How's it going down in Texas?
Oh, it's hot, but it's getting bearable. I think the weather's going to break here pretty quick. I was let me tell all the listeners who Jeff Smith is. He's a former world champion in kickboxing, one of the best point karate fighters ever. And he came up from the second generation of martial arts in the United States. He was formerly from Kingsville, Texas, and he worked out with Pat Burleson in Fort Worth. And then he went up to Washington, D.C., and he trained with June Rhea, is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Tell everybody a little bit about how you got started into martial arts, Jeff.
Well, actually, it was through Alan Steen and Pat Burleson in Texas. But originally, when Alan Steen was training with June Rhea at the University of Texas, one of his black belts was from my hometown and was going to school at the University of Texas. So he was training there, got up to a second-degree black belt. His name was Bruce Turner. Big boy, 6'7", 280. So I got used to fighting the big guys.
Early on. So. Well, you did so fight. You fought a lot of big guys, Ed Daniels, I mean, everybody. Did you fight Everett Eddy also?
A bunch of times, yeah.
Yeah, I thought you fought every big guy that I've ever known. You were like Jeff the Giant Killer.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of guys are intimidated by the bigger guys, but because I grew up fighting those big guys, you know, I felt it was an advantage to fight the big guys because even though they're strong, they're slower, and in point fighting, the advantage is to the faster guy.
That's a fact. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize, I agree with you. I preferred fighting bigger guys because I can get inside of them, and if you could just avoid their long range and get inside, you were the advantage. What I couldn't stand was fighting people shorter than me that could do the same thing to me that I would do to tall guys.
That's right.
I don't know. Did that affect you the same way, or did you feel like you had an advantage when you were taller than the guy you were fighting?
Well, you know, when I was fighting, the psychology of my fighting was I always thought I could beat my opponent, and I trained that way. And if I was fighting somebody smaller, then I looked for the advantages that I had over them. And when I fought somebody bigger, I looked for the advantages there. So I always went into the match with a positive attitude, because in point fighting, you have to totally commit, and if you have any hesitation, your opponent's going to beat you to the punch all the time. Some of my best matches were against Howard Jackson, who was the top point fighter back in those days with Bill Wallace and Joe Louis. And I had good results with him, but you know, he beat me a couple times, and I beat him several times. And
was that 19?
Some good matches.
Was that 1974? Right in that area.
73 was they had the first Pro-Am championships in Ocean City, Maryland, when Bob Maxwell and Harvey Hastings decided to start paying the fighters. Up to that day, we were never getting paid. It was all getting a trophy.
I remember that tournament because we got flyers or posters from that tournament, and it was like unbelievable money, prizes, and we didn't know if it was for real or not. Did everybody get paid? And did everybody
got paid. I won the grand championship, but and that was my one of my first big wins over all the everybody in the top 10 fighters were at that tournament, and I fought the number one. Number one then was Bill Wallace, and so I lined up with him first match.
Right.
Most of the time, the guys, when they go fight these guys, they try to get at the opposite end so they don't have to fight them. You know, my goal was to be number one, and I said, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have to start with the best. So I started with him, and then second, I fought Fred Wren. He was ranked number two at the time. And then I beat Howard a few matches later for the grand championship, and he was ranked number three at the time.
Was Roy Curbit at that tournament?
Roy didn't compete at that tournament. He was probably the only one that wasn't there.
Right.
But everybody else was there. It was one of the biggest. And then I won it again the next year in 74 also.
I remember you were fairly untouchable. One of the best fights that I've ever seen as a fan and during my color belts was when you fought Jim Harrison at the U.S. Championships in the team fights. And you got your nose bloodied, and you stuffed toilet paper up your nose, and you kept fighting. I mean, all the black belts were talking about that. Did you see that? He just stuffed toilet paper up his nose, and he went after it. And I was totally impressed.
Actually, from Ed Daniels, my first black belt tournament, I was fighting Ed Daniels in the finals, and Ed Daniels is a little intimidating, if anybody is, because he back then he was obviously the biggest guy. He was, you know, about 6'7", 6'6", right. About 300 pounds.
Right.
And he had this long front hand, and he had this sidekick that wasn't very high, but he would catch you about in the hip just enough to stop you. Then he'd reach with that front hand, and if he grabbed you, then you were in big trouble.
Right.
So I kept trying to sidekick him, but his arm was longer than my leg.
Right, right.
So what I did a jump reverse sidekick, and I used to do it on the bag, but I never did it in competition, and I just did it because that's the only thing I could do to reach up to his head. And he happened to be coming in with a front hand at the same time and ran right into it.
Oh, really?
And the heel of my foot hit his nose, and I don't think to this day that I ever hit anything harder except maybe breaking boards.
Right.
And I could just feel the bones crunch in his nose, and they never got it stopped bleeding, but he did that. He stuffed the cotton up there and put tape around it, and so you know, I used to watch Jim Harrison. Him and Fred Wren would, you know, be cut up in the finals because we didn't have pads back then.
That's what I was just fixing to ask you. Was this pre-contact gear?
Yes.
Back when they used to say, "Well, are we going to disqualify him?" And they said, "No, he ran into it."
It was impossible to get disqualified because they always. The guys were getting hit. You know, it's not like the guy was running away and you were chasing after him and
right.
hit him and then got disqualified. The guys there would be hit toe to toe. But that was the what they call back then the blood and guts era of Texas hardcore karate.
Right, and I agree. I can remember when the gear came out. They used it on us as like guinea pigs. Demetrius Savannis, and he beat up me and Raymond pretty good the first time he put it on, and that's how we discovered it back when it was a club. You know, it had that little,
yeah.
you had that hand yep. thing, and it just had that round plug on the end of it.
Well, I was working for June Rhee then when he invented all that stuff, so I was the guinea pig, and I'm the one that helped him design it all.
Right.
He would make a new one, and then I'd go spar with it and see where it tore and where the stress points, and he'd go reinforce it and make another one. And so I did all the prototypes. Until, you know, and Pat Worley and John Worley were all up here at that same time.
And Michael Warren, too, is that right?
Yeah, Mike Warren wasn't from our school. He was from a local school in D.C., but
right.
From Kiwon Kim, who was, and they had a whole stable of fighters back then that were good fighters that we were always competing against. We pretty much dominated all the tournaments up the East Coast.
Well, you know, the American fighters, when we fought the Koreans, pretty much dominated the Koreans up until about 1984, and they like segregated from us. They, you know, they went. would that be a true statement?
Well,
because they used to fight us in all the tournaments.
Well, what happened is that they first tried competing, and some of the there were some successful Koreans. David Moon was one.
Oh,
of the,
yeah.
You know, the top guys, but Byung-Yu was another one that was good. But
from Billy Jack.
Yeah. And there was a couple others that were pretty good. But most of them, you know, would get in, and they were good in the Taekwondo rules, but when it came to the open tournaments, they weren't used to the punching.
Right.
And that threw them off. So even though they were real good with the kicking... they weren't able, their defense against the punch wasn't so good, so they had a little trouble. So they weren't too successful except for a handful of them.
Right. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but were the rules the same they are now? No punching to the head and, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, just punch to the body and kicks to the head. Were they doing those same rules? Right.
Well, I see, the thing that I did back then is that a lot of guys just fought in their region, and what I did is I traveled every weekend. We would fight in at least two tournaments a weekend because we'd do local tournaments and then go to a national tournament, or if there was a national tournament, we'd probably only get one in because you'd have to travel too far. But I competed all over the United States and every state in the country.
Right.
I won tournaments in all over Canada, Mexico, Hawaii, Puerto Rico. So, you know, not just the United States.
Right.
And then we went over to Europe, and then we fought almost every country over in Europe and beat the guys there. So part of my reputation was, you know, from people in all the different regions had seen me fight. There was a lot of good fighters that didn't go to every region that a lot of them didn't get to see. unless there was a few people from that region that went to one of the national tournaments. But for the larger groups of the guys who don't travel, you know, there were some really good guys in some of those regions that didn't go to national tournaments. So when you went to their region and with their judges, it can be tough, you know, to get good calls.
Right.
You know, Internationals was notorious for a tough tournament to win, and I won it in 73,
right.
Actually in 74. And when I won it in 74, it was only the second time anybody outside of California had ever won it. And the first one who ever won it before me, 10 years before that, was Alan Steen.
Right. And didn't Pat Burleson, did he win that one also?
No.
Okay, so it was just Mr. Steen?
Yeah, just Alan Steen and I were the only two, and might be to this day.
Well, that was, see, it was Joe Lewis, Chuck Norris, Mike Stone.
Yep, all California guys.
Right.
John Natividad, Donald
right.
Garcia. And all those guys were from California. Benny DeJet, they're all from California.
Well, you know, it was kind of a level playing field when y'all would have come to Dallas at the U.S. Championships. In other words, the guys from California would come, and then you guys from D.C., y'all would come. And when y'all fought here, there wasn't any kind of biased judging. In other words, it was kind of a level playing field.
Well, in Texas, everybody, if you're going to Texas to fight, everybody knew then that you were going to Texas to fight.
Right, exactly.
Well, forget that it was a tournament
right.
and it was points. You just wanted to survive the match. And, you know, sometimes you can win the battle and lose the war. But when you go down to Texas, you know that every one of those fights is a war.
Right. Well, there was a lot of unknown guys that didn't travel, you know, nationally and in Dallas, Fort Worth. And
that were tough fighters.
Right, exactly.
And that's what I was saying. And there was other regions like that, too, that, you know, Texas had theirs. And you grew up in Texas, so you knew a lot of them.
Right.
But, you know, when a lot of the big names from outside of Texas would come down there, a lot of the local guys who you know, were real good would bump them off because they weren't really, you know, they were kind of sleepers. They really didn't expect them to be that good.
Well, Billy Watson was one of those guys. He fought both sides out equally, and, you know, so his timing was good. He didn't look like, he looked kind of like a marshmallow kind of.
Oh, let me tell you, and Billy Watson was my nemesis.
Was he really?
As a brown belt, I never could beat him.
Right.
And, you know, I went to every tournament in Texas as a brown belt.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, June Reed wanted me to test for my black belt, but because I couldn't beat Billy, and I had taken second place at every tournament for the whole year before I got my black belt, and I lost every time to Billy Watson. So he got his black belt, and I stayed brown belt, and then the next four tournaments I competed in, I won first.
Right.
And then I tested for my black belt, and then I got to get my revenge on him when I when I got to fight him as a black belt.
Right, right.
Well, and I finally beat him.
Wasn't your first Grand Championship match with Ed Daniels?
Well, that was my first black belt tournament, but I actually lost to Ed after that jump kick to the nose like that.
Oh, you did?
They you know, Texas, they won't disqualify you, but and this is how hard you have to hit somebody. I hit him that hard. And they gave me a minus point.
Oh, they did? They gave a point to him or just took one off from
you?
Yeah,
they gave him a point.
Right, right. Well, let's take a little break here. We'll be right back. This is Jeff Overture from WTFRadio.me, and we'll be right back. Okay, this song is called Dirty Little Secret by Madonna Nash.
My dirty little secret. My dirty little secret. Like you do. Each day I pray I forget about ya. Even that makes me think about you too. Don't know how you done it, but you done me in. I haven't told a soul, even my best friend. If anyone finds out, all the trouble will be in. You are my dirty little secret. I won't tell if you don't tell. Don't know how much longer I can keep it. This is like nothing that I've ever felt. Don't know what I'm doing, but it sure feels good. If you're gonna tell it, well, I wish you would. I'm holding on to something and I don't think I can keep it. My dirty little
little secret. From everybody that we know, one slip and it's running like a wildfire. I'm about ready to explode. Every day I want to shout it from the roof, but that would ruin everything and that won't do. And every chance I get, I find a way to be with you. You're my dirty little secret. I won't tell if you don't tell. Don't know how much longer I can keep it. This is like nothing that I've ever. It feels good. If you're gonna tell it, well, I wish you would. I'm holding on to something and I don't think I can keep it. My dirty little secret. Feels good. If you're gonna tell it, well, I wish you would. I'm holding on to something and I don't think I can keep it. You're my dirty little secret. I won't tell if you don't tell. Don't know how much longer I can keep it. This is like nothing that I've ever felt. Don't know what I'm doing, but it sure feels good. If you're gonna tell it, well, I wish you would. I'm holding on to something and I don't think.
Okay, I'm back. This is Jeff Overturf with WTFRadio.me. Well, Mr. Smith, we were talking, we were off just a second there, and we were talking a little bit about your tournament experience. You said you lost to Ed Daniels in that particular tournament. What other notable tournaments did you fight in? Okay, I have a question. I never asked you this yet. What was your worst beating? And we all have one. You know, everybody says, I can remember that beating. What was your worst beating? You know, it could be competition. It couldn't be, you know, but it would be nice if it was competition. What was yours?
Well, you know, my kickboxing record, I was 30 wins and one loss, and that loss was on a split decision. But in my kickboxing career, for those 31 fights, I was never knocked down or knocked out. So I never, in kickboxing, took a beating.
What about in point karate? Because
in point karate, probably my toughest fight back in point fighting was probably Jim Buten back then, and I had my first encounter with Fred Wren, which that was memorable too.
Right. Well, of course.
Anybody who fights Fred Wren, you're going to take a beating, whether you win or lose.
Right. Exactly. Because he wants to hit you.
And it didn't matter if you hit him first, he's going to hit you two or three times afterwards, or if he hits you first and then you hit him, he's going to hit you two or three times after that.
No, that's a fact. You know,
with the judges trying to pull him off.
I tell a lot of people this, and they don't believe me when I say this. I say, well, Jeff, you know, what was your training like? You know, they always want to talk about kickboxing because I was a kickboxer. And I tell everybody, I said, my worst beating was never in kickboxing. It was always in point karate. And they say, well, how could that be? I said, you just don't get it. That gear, it weighs less than 4 ounces, and they hit you. You know, it's like a street fight. I mean, you know, you're getting hit. It's not like that, you know, they're pulling it too much. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I've always referenced to point karate because we had more padding on the gloves when we fought in kickboxing.
Yep, and I'm kind of the same. That would be my same answer also. You know, fighting Jim Buten, you know, I fought him a couple times in point fighting, and when I fought him in kickboxing, you know, that's when I was the world champion, and I fought him in one of my title defenses here in Washington, D.C. And the reason I fought him is because I had lost to him at a point tournament, so I wanted to get a little revenge on him.
Right.
And fought him here in Washington, D.C., and he had Bill Wallace in his corner.
Right.
And, of course, Bill told me he was going to work his corner because he didn't bring a corner man. You know, he came all the way from Texas and he didn't have anybody with him.
Right.
So Bill worked his corner, but I finally got my revenge on him. I knocked him down every round, and back then, the rule, it was that 10-8. Fight was a 9-round fight, and it was scheduled for 9 rounds. It actually stopped in the 5th because what they did, if you knocked him down, that ended the round.
Right. Oh, it did?
It ended the round if you knocked the guy down.
Well, we had a 3-down.
They would give him a standing count because they were afraid somebody was going to get hurt. They didn't know. You know, this is the first time they'd been doing this. So they had the rules, and TV was very adamant about safety on the fighters because, you know, for all they knew, somebody was going to get up there and somebody was going to get killed, and then, you know, it was going to kill the sport, and the major studios would get sued and everything. So they were very protective. And so in some of the first fights, that's how the PKA rules were that way.
Well, did you hit him to the body a lot? Is that how you got him?
I hit him to the head. I hit him to the body. I hit him every damn where.
Oh, really?
Because I got inside those long legs of his.
Right.
And then I would be, you know, wailing on him. And then as he moved away, then I would kick. And then I would be back on him with the hands. Well, so until, you know, he went down. And then, you know, kind of like old Texas point fighting.
Well, I don't ever remember you backing up, ever. Every time I saw you fight, you never backed up. And it was like you were shot out of a cannon. Your conditioning must have been great because you were active the whole time you fought. And I don't ever remember you being tired in point karate or kickboxing.
Yeah, I fought 12-round fights. And if you see some of the matches in the 12th round, I'm moving and kicking and punching and throwing as many punches and kicks in the last round as the first round. And that's how we trained back then. You know, a lot of guys, you know, would train, but, you know, we trained, you know, and I had a whole stable of guys up here. You know what, when PKA started, and we had the number one contender or the world champion in every weight class from our school here in Washington, D.C.
Now, what year was that?
That was 74 is when it first, you know,
right,
started kickboxing. So in 75, see, originally there was only four weight classes. In that first world championships in 74, there was the lightweight, and Howard Jackson had injured his knee about a month before this tournament, and it was still bothering him, so he wasn't able to perform his best. He ended up losing to Ramon Smith, who was a Junior black belt from the Dominican Republic.
Right.
And then he fought the... Ramon Smith fought Isaias Duenas from Mexico City, one of David Moon's black belts.
Right.
And Isaias Duenas won the lightweight, you know, beat Ramon.
Right.
And then Bill Wallace won the middleweight, and then I won the light heavyweight over Wally Slocke, and then Joe Lewis won the heavyweight.
Right.
And then about 6 months to a year later, they added a super lightweight, and Gordon Franks from our Washington, D.C. school became the super lightweight world champion when he beat Romero Guzman, who was one of Isaias Duenas' stablemates, one of David Moon's black belts.
Well, Gordon,
and he had won some South American championships and some European championships and was like the number one guy. So we got Gordon Franks in with a match with him. And Gordon Franks actually trained with Pat Worley and was one of Pat Worley's first black belts up here in Washington, D.C. at one of Junior's schools. So we had Gordon as the world champion in the super lightweight. In the lightweight division, Michael Coles, who was the number one contender and U.S. champion. And then the middleweight was Rodney Batiste, who this was after he became the middleweight champion number one contender in the middleweight U.S. champion in the middleweight division after Bill Wallace retired.
Right.
and then I was a light heavyweight world champion. And heavyweight division, though, was the only one we didn't have have a fighter in because we didn't have any heavyweights.
Right.
I was the heaviest that we had on the team, and I was only 184 was our weight class for the light heavyweight division.
Now, what year was that that y'all had the team fight here in Dallas? It was the best team fights I ever saw, and it was you, Gordon Franks, Michael Cole, Pat Worley.
Yeah, Mike Cole's Pat Worley, Wayne Van Buren.
And was it John Worley also?
No, I think maybe Otis Hooper was what, maybe our super lightweight. You know, I'd have to look at one of the pictures. But it was memorable for us, too, because of a couple things happened then. That was the first time that, you know, we moved up to Washington, D.C. in 1970, and this was 1973.
Right.
Where they had the team championships at the U.S. Championships. And, of course, you know, Chuck Norris and everybody else had their teams there. Ken Knutson's teams from Chicago and Glenn Keeney and all those guys from the Midwest and Joe Corley and all the guys from the Southwest. And, I mean, there was teams all over.
And you had Kansas City
Detroit,
was there.
Detroit, you know, Everett Eddy and Johnny Lee, the
right.
Monster Man Eddy, and their teams from Detroit and, you know, the guys from Colorado. And, I mean, this was the biggest team championships in the country.
All right, well, let's take a little break here. We'll be right back. We're going to talk a little bit more about that team fight and how y'all did at the U.S. Championships. We'll be right back. This is Jeff Overturf and Jeff Smith. We'll be right back. Okay, the song coming up is called Say Your Goodbyes by Chris Watson from Denton, Texas, a local boy.
Because you know it's time for me to go. So say your goodbyes now, baby. Because you know it's time for me to go. I don't love you because you know it's time for me to go. Say your goodbyes, baby, because you know it's time for me to go. Walk right through that front door.
Okay, I'm back. I'm with Jeff Smith. This is Jeff Overturf with WTFRadio.me. Before we took a break, Jeff, we were talking about that team that y'all brought down here to Dallas, Texas. And if I remember correctly, y'all won the team fights that year. Is that correct?
Yeah, we did. It was a tough fight, though, and it was with the Texas. It all came down to Washington, D.C. versus Texas. But our Washington, D.C. team had, you know, half the guys on that team were from Texas. So
right.
It was almost like Texas fighting itself.
Right.
But a couple of things were memorable about that. One was it's the first time that any team wore a colored uniform.
I remember that. Y'all had,
we had red uniforms, and everybody were calling us fags and names and, you know, all kinds of stuff, you know, for wearing them girly uniforms.
Right.
And we look, because everybody wore black or white, or, you know, even like the Tracys had some kind of black plaid look or, you know, texture to it. But nobody had a colored uniform.
Right. Those were.
And we started that red uniform up here for our Black Belt Club members. If anybody was, you know, signed up for Black Belt, then they got to wear a red uniform.
Right.
And so we came with our red uniforms, and so we had to prove ourselves a little bit. But, you know, after we won the team championships and then the next national tournament after that, everybody had colored uniforms.
Right.
I mean, there was, like, yellow ones then, and it was green. It's like opened the floodgates.
Yes, it did. Y'all were trendsetters, there's no doubt about it. You know, when y'all came down here, y'all were throwing techniques that we didn't use in Texas, like I never threw a crescent kick. Nobody threw a crescent kick until I saw you and Pat Worley.
Right.
Threw a crescent kick. Y'all do a crescent kick, spin kick, and they'd come over the top with the right hand. And y'all were like bouncing. In other words, y'all were always in motion. And, you know, so y'all would come off your kicks with punches and with a lot of leverage. And we didn't do that. You know, we were more counter fighters and defensive fighters, like stay low, come up with hands,
right,
and side kicks and turn
kicks.
Everything
in Texas back then was a solid stance because that was the old traditional style.
Right.
But when I came up to Washington, D.C., and I started fighting a variety of opponents, you know, went to New York and we went down to Florida and all up the East Coast and Detroit, and, you know, you started picking up other styles. We'd go up to Canada and fight through Canada all the way from Vancouver all the way over to Toronto and all up through those different areas in Canada. And what I found out about the moving fighters, it made it much harder to hit them when they were moving. And a body in motion, it's harder to detect when if you go from a dead still to a motion, it's easier to pick it up than if it's already moving and then it takes off.
You know, Bill Wallace, on his seminars, he says the same thing about disguising his kicks by that little back and forth bounce he does.
Yeah.
And so he explained that at the we had a seminar here in April of 2001, I believe it was, with everybody and who's anybody in karate. And he covered that. And I can remember when I was coming up, I was influenced by Muhammad Ali about using footwork when you would fight. So as a blue belt, I started moving when I would fight, and it was very successful for me also.
And the thing about the footwork, though, what everybody found out, though, is when you started moving like that, it takes a lot more stamina.
Yes.
So if you can't jump rope, you know, and we would jump rope for like an hour, and, you know, if you can't jump rope, you know, that means you can't bounce around like that.
So right.
We did so much rope jumping and road work and that kind of stuff, along with all our, you know, hours of fighting, that I could bounce all day.
Well, you know, we were talking earlier today when we decided to do the show tonight. You were telling me a little bit about your training. What was your training like back in the day? You know, say 71 through 74, what was your normal training regimen?
Well, my normal training regimen was not normal.
Okay.
Pat Worley and John Worley and those guys would always tell me I'm crazy, I train too much, and every time I would be trying to drag them in to train with me, and they trained a lot, but you know, I basically was training three times a day, and I was training 6 days a week.
Well, I'm doing that now.
Yeah, and I would work out in the morning.
Right.
And then I would teach a noon class at the school, and then I'd work out in the afternoon, and then I would teach the afternoon and evening class, and then when the evening class was finished, we would work out till midnight.
I don't know what commercial that is on TV, but it's true. It says a body in motion stays in motion. And when you get older, right. If you get sedentary or you kick back, your body will attack you and say, stay still forever.
That's right.
You got to keep moving all the time. Now, and training also. And, you know, it's like, I don't remember who said this. It might have been Arnold Schwarzenegger. He says, the more the body can endure, the longer it will last. And I said, you know, that makes a lot of sense because I used to weight train. I used to run. I used to do a lot of bag work, a lot of rounds. And the only person in our gym that trained more than me was Greek. I mean, Demetrius was a freak. He was the guy that overtrained. Everybody said he's overtraining and all that stuff.
Absolutely. But he was always in condition. You know, he was one of my favorite guys. And, you know, I used to watch him when he was a brown belt. You know, I was black belt that time. But I used to watch him. And, you know, he never lost a match.
Right.
A match in brown belt.
Right.
He beat every single person and won every single tournament.
Well, to my understanding, they made him go up for his black belt.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, like, he was so dominant. And, you know, and I don't think a lot of black belts were wanting him to go up for black belt. You know, it's like, do we got to fight
that
guy? Because he was, you know, he had a 20-inch sidekick, you know. In other words, full power, full extension, 20 inches long because he had such a tight fold. So you could be working him over with your hands and you think, I got this. You know, you're good fixing to lower the boom on him. Then all of a sudden you were on the ground with your air knocked out of you. And, you know, and you would be inside your reach with your arms, and you'd get killed, you know, with a sidekick.
You know, I've got a lot of Demetrius stories. You know, as he was coming up, you know, I always admired his training regimen. You know, one of the things we used to watch him at the tournaments before the tournament starts, and hell, he'd do a 2 or 3 hour workout at the tournament and be soaking wet.
Yes.
Before, you know, most guys you see them all day during the tournament, they're laying around. They're kicked back, you know, on the bleachers, you know, with their uniform underneath their head and taking a nap and chilling. And he's over there jumping rope, doing push-ups, doing sit-ups, hitting the bag, hitting the hand pads, and just, you know, worked up a massive sweat. But it would do that for a couple hours before he would even fight.
He had that weighted vest on and ankle weights, and he'd be shadow boxing.
Ankle weights.
Right. Oh, yeah, he was intense. And but, you know, he was a great fighter just like you were. So, I mean, and plus he was a crowd pleaser like you.
He was not just a technician. You know, when I was doing my kickboxing, I also during that time was doing the color commentating on a lot of the ESPN shows.
Right.
And we did one in El Paso, and I got me some Tony Lama boots at the Tony Lama factory there in El Paso. And we had tuxedos on because they wanted us to look, sharp on the TV. But then we had our cowboy hats with our boots on with our tuxedos.
Right.
But Demetrius was fighting the main event at that tournament there in El Paso, so I got to call the play-by-play. And the stuff that he did, I mean, he hit this guy. He knocked the guy down with like six different techniques. Jump reverse sidekick, you know.
Was that
front leg axe, and I mean, just all kinds of stuff that you don't ever see.
Was that the Jarrett fight where he knocked him down with a jump turn kick to the mouth?
Exactly.
Oh yeah, that was a hell of a fight. And you know what was amazing was Jarrett kept coming back.
Was like that. It reminded me of one of those Chuck Norris movies where Chuck kept killing this guy, and the guy kept getting up after he'd shoot him.
I remember that movie.
And then come back, and I'm going, man, does this guy ever stay down?
Right, because all the time you were thinking, because he did those body shots, then he came over the top of that left hook, and I was thinking, well, that's the end of that fight, and boom, he got back up.
Spinning back fist, I mean, anything, boom, and there he goes down again, and he's back up again.
Well, you know, you were a tough fighter yourself. I mean, you know, because you took some beatings, and you didn't stop. I mean, That's all we talked about after the U.S. Championship was that fight between you and Jim Harrison. And then the fight between Jim Harrison and Roger Carpenter. And
Roger was a good fighter. I fought Roger in that same team championships. We fought the New England team, and Roger was captain of their team, and I was captain of mine, and I had to fight him.
Right.
You know, at that same tournament, I had to fight Everett Eddy. He was captain of their team. And a funny story with Everett Eddy, you know, he was a monster man, and he, you know, this guy was, he was 6'3", but he was about 280.
Right, I remember
And he
him.
Had this big barrel chest, and he had a beard, and he just was not the, he was always got a growl on his face, and, you know, most guys, you know, they would socialize with each other. He would, like, be like he was mad all the time, you know. So he was trying to intimidate everybody. Well, we're fighting his team, and it's the last match, and we're 1 point down.
Right.
And so I go up to fight Everett Eddy, and I beat Eddy by 1 point. So now we're tied, and so I get ready to go off the stage, and they tell, you know, the referee says, send up another fighter. We're going to do a one match sudden death.
Right.
You know, for another round. You had to fight a complete round.
Yeah.
And send up a fighter. Well, they sent Everett Eddy back up.
Right.
And so I started to come down, and then Pat Worley and John Worley and those guys going, no, get your ass back up there.
Right.
You're going to fight him. We're not going to fight him.
Well, you were hot that day because you beat Demetrius in that team fight, and you said earlier that y'all were 4 points down, and Demetrius got his mouth cut that day by Al Dacascos or something, if I remember correctly.
Well, and I hit him with a round kick, and I hit him with a round kick in it, and it opened it back up, and he was bleeding, and then I hit him with a ridge hand
right.
in it, and he was bleeding, and, you know, if it was any other tournament in the country, they'd have probably disqualified me, but, you know, in Texas, blood, you know, most tournaments, they say, oh, blood's disqualification. In Texas, you know, it has to be death is probably the only disqualification.
It was a good point. He ran into it. I didn't see it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you hear all kinds of comments like that.
Yeah.
All right, let's take another little break. We'll be right back. This is Jeff Over Turf with Jeff Smith. Okay, this song coming up is called Burn by Ashley Lee.
You tried to hurt me, and now you want me, and I don't know what to say. You're kind of dirty, yeah, you burned me, but everything is okay. We were on a roller coaster, but look a little closer. You saw a little kitty turn tiger in me. Smooth operator, talk to your lady. You get what's coming to ya, little boy. So don't come any closer, cause it's already over. You're ungrateful, hateful. All you do is push and pull, dragging every woman in your direction. Ladies, it's crazy, confident, it's guaranteed. Hips turn you into one of his possessions. Time for the tables to turn. I'll get married, binge, and I'll just keep burning.
Yeah. fishing pool, dragging every woman in your direction.
You're ungrateful, hateful. All you do is push and pull, dragging every woman in your direction. Ladies, it's crazy. Positive, it's guaranteed. Hits turn you into one hit possession. Time for the tables to turn. I'm getting my revenge, and I'm just getting burned. And I'm just getting burned. And I'm just getting burned. And you'll just get burned.
Okay, we're back. This is Jeff Overturf with Jeff Smith. Jeff, you know, I know I have my personal story about when and how I got started in karate when I was 16 years old. What was your story and how old were you?
I was 14, and when I started, you know, my mother worked at the university. Texas A&I University was in Kingsville. It's now Texas A&M University at Kingsville is... you know, A&M was buying up all the small universities and converting them over to A&M's, you know, for they have their satellite schools. But that's in Kingsville. And my mother ran the bookstore there. And I used to deliver newspapers, and I delivered them out at the university to the dorms and the surrounding neighborhood. And when I was up at the Student Union ballroom, I mean, up at the Student Union, I saw posters for karate demonstration, and this was during the summer. And so I said, oh, I'm going to go check this out. And they had a karate program that was Bruce Turner doing a demonstration, and he started a program that summer. And that's how I got started, and that was back in 64.
Now, was this at a recreation center? Is that what you said?
Yeah, it was a Student Union ballroom.
Okay.
You know, they're at the university.
Uh-huh.
And he was, you know, he went to University of Texas, and he was getting his graduate degree. He was working on his master's degree, but he was home in that summer because his parents lived in Kingsville, and he was taking some classes at A&I, and that's how when he started the program. And so that's how I got started. And then one of my neighbors, Johnny Woolley and Jeff Woolley, two brothers, they were classmates of mine from school. They came too, and they actually started in the summer, and I didn't get a chance to start. You know, I saw the demonstration, and then they saw it too, and they didn't tell me they were going to start.
Oh, so they want to get a leg up on you.
They got to jump up on me, because then September came around, and Bruce went back to the University of Texas. And now Johnny and Jeff, and there was one other guy that was a purple belt. Well, they were the highest ranking. John and Jeff got their green belt.
Right.
You know, it only went white, green, back then blue and brown and black. So
right.
There was only like four or five belts.
Right.
And they were already a green belt then. So they were running the school with this purple belt. So that's who was actually teaching.
Well, you know, back in those days, that kind of stuff happened because, you know, you just took what you could get. So did Mr. Turner, did he work out with June Rhee at Texas or San Marcos?
At University of Texas, he was with Alan Steen, and those guys, you know, Alan Steen was one of, you know, Master Rhee's first black belts from the University of Texas, and Bruce Turner was right down the line a few notches back.
Right. So how did you migrate from Kingsville, Texas, and all the way up to Fort Worth with Pat Burleson? How did that
happen? Well, what happened is we started, you know, getting our club going there, and we kept it going. And so we wanted to go to the tournaments, so we started going to all the tournaments. And so every time we would go up to Dallas and Fort Worth, we would work out with Alan Steen and Pat Burleson because we were June Rhee black belts or June Rhee students then. We weren't even black belts yet.
Right.
And of course, we were doing well in the tournaments. This little, you know, little Kingsville here was placing in all the tournaments, and I was taking second place or first place in the divisions. And so they, you know, they watch the fighters. They know who's winning. That brown belt division is a big thing. And at Alan Steen's U.S. championships in 66, Pat Worley and I were fighting for the championship.
Now, Pat was already with Pat Burleson up in Fort Worth, is that correct?
Yeah, he was with Chuck Lovin, who was one of one of Burleson's black belts.
Right.
And he was training there with his brother John and Larry Carnahan and Gary Hestelow and these guys from Texas.
Now, didn't you go?
I became friends with Pat, after the U.S. Championships because we fought for first. You know, he beat me at that tournament. But what I would do when we would go to those tournaments, we would pick up the techniques that they were using. You know, I watched how Fred was throwing the ridge hand and how Pat Worley was kicking and how guys were punching. And so then we would take those things back and work on them.
Right.
And then, June Ree, because he knew that Bruce Turner started the club, he agreed, we talked to him and asked him if we paid his way, would he come down and do a testing for us each semester? So that's how we were getting our rank. He was coming each semester to do the testing for us.
Oh, okay.
So that's how the little Kingsville and Jeff Woolley, Johnny Woolley and Jeff Woolley, the two Woolley brothers, because they started before me, they actually got their black belt before me. And Johnny actually fought Joe Lewis for the Grand Championship at June Ree's National Championships in 1965.
Now, where was that located?
Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay, in 65. Well, uh-huh. Did you go to Tarrant County Junior College up in Fort Worth at some point? Or
no, I went to the University of Texas. I was in Kingsville in junior high and high school, and then when I graduated, I went to Texas A&I there in Kingsville. But in the summer, we would go up to Austin and train with the club up there, where Johnny Woolley was.
Right.
And Carlton Morris was another one of our black belts from Kingsville, and Billy McCoy was one of my black belt students. And so these guys were winning a lot of tournaments back then, or placing, Friday, fighting Fred Wren and Jim Buten and all those guys, Texas guys back then.
Right. Well, let's take another little break here. We'll be right back. This is Jeff Overturf with Jeff Smith at WTFRadio.me. Okay, this song is called Fighting the Chill by Chris Watson.
The pull of a memory.
Okay, I'm back. This is Jeff Overturf with Jeff Smith. And while we were gone, we were talking a little bit about Texas A&I. When I was growing up in South Texas at Victoria in the 60s, I can remember hearing about all these magnificent and world-class sprinters and track stars from that particular area. So who were the, some of the guys that were down there with
Texas
you?
Yeah, Texas A&I was, you know, notorious for such a small college, and it was a small college. But, you know, they had Darryl Green, who came from there, Eugene Upshaw. You know, these were both, you know, Pro Bowl Hall of Famers, you know, now, you know, both inducted in the Hall of Fame. And Darryl Green played for the Redskins, and Eugene Upshaw played for one of the other pro teams. But Eugene Upshaw went on to become the president of the Players Association for years, up until a couple years ago. And, you know, real famous. But out of the 4 years that I was going to A&I, they won the NAIA championships, which is the National Small College Championships, 2 out of the 4 years, and went to the finals the other 2 years.
Right.
So they always had some great teams, but and they still are producing players that are playing in the National Football League.
Oh, I know they do. You know, and it's always good to be in a community or an area where you have a lot of known athletes. You know, like Texas has always been king in baseball, football, and in some places, like UTEP had the great basketball players that won the national championship, the first black team to ever do it. And so we were pretty fortunate to come from the state of Texas and be surrounded by great athletes and, you know, multiple sports. And I know that I played multiple sports when I was coming up, but once I got in karate, I kind of quit everything and stayed with karate when I was 16. And I noticed that you had mentioned June Reed quite a bit in your career down in Austin and Kingsville and stuff like that. How did you migrate with June Reed up to Washington, D.C.? How'd that happen?
Well, June Reed was still, you know, he set up all his black belts started, you know, spreading around different parts of the country, and when they went to universities and even through Texas, there was a whole bunch of places through Texas, you know, in Galveston, you know, Fred Simon.
Oh yeah,
had a June Reed school there, and a whole bunch of guys. I mean, it's amazing, you know, everybody in Texas. You know, these black belts, they were so dedicated to the martial arts, and June Reed created that, you know, that image for them, you know, being, you know, the first person to teach Taekwondo in America and being the foremost grandmaster of Taekwondo. He had a major influence on everybody's life, and that you just didn't become a student. You know, he was so charismatic that he would make you, you know, change your vision of what you wanted to aspire to be.
I know.
And, you know, so many of our guys, you know, it's like Alan Steen and Pat Burleson had schools, and multiple schools from their black belts had schools. And, I mean, he really, through the Texas connection, because that's where June Reed came as a foreign exchange student at San Marcos University.
That's correct.
And then he came back to University of Texas as a student.
Right. You know, one thing I love about June Reed, he is so cool the way he talks. He is so calm. It's like that I have on video, and I put it on Facebook, and it's really a famous video of June Reed's. It's like he goes, exercise is every day, not every other day. He goes, you eat, you sleep, you exercise every day because your body is on a 24-hour cycle. I know that speech word for word. I mean, and then he did 106 push-ups in a minute and stood there with a glass of water on his head with his foot in the air with a microphone in his hand at 67 years of age.
Yep, and he's quite inspirational. So when I was testing for my black belt, and I was running the club there at Texas A&I, he asked me if I would come up to Washington, D.C. and teach for him, because one of his black belts, Jack Dutcher, who was also a good national competitor, he had left and opened up his own school and took all the black belts. So June Reed didn't have any instructors, and he had 5 schools then.
Right.
So I said, sure, I'll come. And so I had about a half a year to go to finish my degree, And so I told him, I said, well, I can only come though if you can get me in a university. So he got me in a in a school in Washington D.C. and gave me a scholarship to come up and was going to pay for my the rest of my education if I would come up and do it. So I did. And of course, on the way up, you know, I was telling Pat Worley that I was going to Washington D.C. And then Pat Worley goes, well, I want to come, get me a job. So when I got up here, I called, I talked to Grandmaster Ri, and I told him I had some of my good friends that were national competitors and good, you know, Jun Ri black belts from Alan Steen and Pat Burleson and Chuck Levin and all these guys. And he said, well, okay, if you think that they would be a good fit. And I said, yeah. So then Pat got his brother, John. He said, well, John just lost his job. Can he come too?
Right.
So John came up with him, and then after they got up there, it wasn't 2 weeks. They were bringing their buddy Gary Hestelow, who later became president of Century. And this was later after he came up to Washington D.C. and then he went to Minneapolis with John and Pat to open their schools, and then later went to Century. But and then they brought Larry Carnahan after that. And then we brought a couple of Fred Simon's black belts, Gary Jones and Danny Evsen, Evstein, I think it was his last name. I can't remember Danny's last name, but he was one of Larry Carnahan's black belts. And they just kept on, you know, like bringing all these Texas connection. Well, what happened when we came up to Washington, D.C., the guys up here had all these flashy, fancy techniques, but they didn't have that hardcore kick-your-ass Texas style of fighting.
Right.
So when we came up, we were like sponges, because every time we'd go to a tournament, we'd pick up techniques in Texas, you know.
Right.
That's how we learned. And so up there, we were going to all these tournaments in New York and Philadelphia and, North Carolina and, you know, just up and down the East Coast and Chicago, you know, up in the Midwest and Kansas and all these areas, and picking up all these techniques. And when we combined the flashy technique of the East Coast guys and the hardcore fighting of the Texas style, we started dominating a lot of tournaments.
Well, y'all must have had a field day up there, because I can remember the East Coast. I thought they were kind of flashy, but I didn't think they, in other words, the contact wasn't there. In other words, the commitment to the technique, to the target, wasn't as important.
You're exactly right, and we changed that whole system of how people fight, and then they started fighting like us, and they actually became very good fighters. I mean, and it wasn't they weren't good fighters, it's just that's how the rules they were used to.
Right.
But, California was no different.
Oh, really?
Oh, no, California, those guys were flashy.
Right.
But in California, you would get disqualified in a heartbeat if you touched somebody in the face.
Mr. C mentioned that when I did that show with him and Pat Burleson. He said something about that also.
Great fighters, but they were just playing by the rules. And it was the same thing with the East Coast guys. But what we did is we didn't punch them in the face, because if we touched their face, they would disqualify us on the East Coast.
Oh, really?
So what we did is the old Texas rule of if you kill the body, the head will die.
Oh, that's a fact.
And we wouldn't. We would just pound them to the body so hard that it would just knock the wind out of them.
Oh yeah.
Well, they let us sweep, and I used to just sweep people all over the place and bounce them off the ground. And then, of course, we had a few of our Texas habits of once they hit the ground, we had to stomp on them or
right.
Follow them down with a punch. And as long as we didn't hit their head and bounce it off the floor,
right.
They were letting us do that.
Right. Well, back then in those days, the point was a technique that would end a street fight. And, in other words, it had to be solid. And anything could have been a point. I've mentioned this on several shows, but Raymond threw a drop butt on a guy's head on the concrete at the U.S. Championships, and everybody looked around at each other, and all the flags went up. All he did was drop his ass and hit him in the forehead, and crack, it hit that concrete. And nobody knew what to do, but they said, man, that was awesome point. So there was a lot of that going on. And also, Pat Worley was pretty good about doing takedowns. and a follow up on the ground. I know Demetrius was fantastic, and you were also. And you guys, you know, y'all were the trendsetters and the real pioneers of martial arts as far as competition, commercial karate, which brings up another point. How did everything evolve up on the Northeast Coast? Because when I've talked to you in the last couple times of the last week, you've been talking about Australia, New Zealand. You've been talking about how you have these people come in from other countries, and they meet you up in your place up in Virginia.
You know, one of my black belts when I was running the Junry, you know, I ran Junry schools for him for 20 years up here.
Right.
Before I started my own, basically, when his son, who did the Nobody Bothers Me commercials, got old enough, he was like 6 years old then. When he got old enough to run his schools, then he put him in charge of his schools. And I decided then it was time for me, now that he had somebody to run his schools, that I could start my own schools.
Right.
And Steve Oliver, who was from Oklahoma, who was also a Junry black belt, you know, I started going and doing all these satellite schools at all these universities where Junry had all these black belts in Texas and Oklahoma and throughout the South. He had all of these college programs going, so every semester, you know, he didn't have time to go do all the testing, so I'd end up going doing the testing. And I met Steve Oliver, and he asked me if he could come up to Washington, D.C. He was going to go to college there at Georgetown University and wanted to know if he could get a job. And I said, well, you better come up one summer and train first and get your black belt, and we'll see. So he came up and stayed one summer as a brown belt and competed in some tournaments and did quite well up there and tested for his black belt, and then went back and finished his degree at Oklahoma, and then came up to do his graduate work at Georgetown University, and then we got him a job there in Washington, D.C. And then when he graduated from Georgetown, he then moved out to Denver, Colorado, and opened a chain of schools. And in the first year, he had opened six schools he opened in the first 18 months that he was there, which back then was unheard of. So, and he was a great business guy, you know, and really sharp, a good technician. But, you know, he was then competing with me and Batiste and Coles and all these guys here. So he told us, he said, look, I'm not going to be a professional fighter. He said, you guys can do that. He said, I'm going to use my head. And he would get in there and fight with us, but, you know, he made it a point, you know, that he didn't want us scrambling his brains because he needed them for his business education.
Right, exactly.
And he is, and to this day, is one of the sharpest business guys to come, you know, up through the martial arts. So he started a franchising about 5 years ago and asked me if I would do it with him. And so we started franchising schools and have started expanding them and now have schools all over the United States and Canada and New Zealand and Australia. And then a couple years ago, we decided to purchase NATMA magazine. And NATMA is the National Association of Professional Martial Artists.
Oh, I know the
magazine. That was originally started by John Graydon,
who
was
Florida.
One of Joe Louis's black belts.
That's in Florida, right?
Yes.
Okay, I remember that magazine.
And when he started, I used to go down and do seminars for John and Jim and help them run their schools because their instructor originally was Walt Bone, who was from Texas, who was a good friend of mine. And so I would go down and do seminars for them. And then when John was going to start the magazine, I helped him get the magazine started. And Joe Corley helped him also, as well as Bill Clark and some other people. And we decided to purchase that after John Graydon had gotten a lawsuit with Century. And Century owned it after that. And Century had its own magazine, so they didn't need it, but so we ended up purchasing it from them and still have it and have about 1,500 schools that we do consulting for through the NATMA magazine. And it's a consulting thing where they get a monthly newsletter and a packet of information that tells them how to run their schools and how to market how to teach the classes and do retention and increase their gross and cut their expenses and things like that. You know, martial arts business stuff.
Right.
And, you know, and Pat Burleson was one of the first pioneers of moving martial arts from a club and a non-profit thing to making it a real business, and implemented a lot of business systems that June Rhee was even using in Washington, D.C., that we still use some of those systems that he implemented even today with some minor tweaking.
Well, you know, Pat approached me at the U.S. Championships this last year, and he introduced me to the guy that had a booth up there that does some sort of something similar to what you are doing. I can't remember the guy's name. I don't know if he's with you guys or not, but I wish I could remember the guy's name.
Greg Silva?
You know, I don't know if it's...
Or was it Bill Clark? Or
no, what's the name of your system?
Mile High Karate.
Mile High Karate? I don't know if that's it or not. I can't remember. But all of you
it
guys...
It might have. We did a seminar a year or two ago in San Antonio and had a lot of people there. Pat Burleson came over with a bunch of other black belts, you know, from that area.
Right. Well, you've... So what was this thing you were doing this week? You had some guys in from New Zealand and Australia. How does that work? I mean, they're coming. That's a commitment, flying from halfway around the world.
You know, in New Zealand, we have one school, and in Australia, we have one, and we just opened another one in New Zealand. You know, we have what are called regional directors, and a regional developer, a regional director is responsible for developing his region. And you buy an area, and then just like any franchise does, if you're going to, you know, get a McDonald's franchise, or if you're going to get a Subway or anything like that, if you're going to franchise, the first thing you do is you buy a single unit, or you buy a multi unit, or you buy an area.
Right.
And if you buy a region, then anybody who opens a location has to open it through you.
Right.
So that's kind of the same way he expanded through the Mile High Karate.
Well, when you'll have a competitor come in that area, they don't wind up in the trunk of somebody's car, do they?
No, it's not that old school style.
No, that was
we encourage competition.
That's not too far from the truth.
And most of them don't want to open near us because we tend to flood the market and pull a lot of the students away, so it doesn't, you know, kind of pick the bones clean. There's not a whole lot left.
Right.
But so, yeah, that whole system of franchising. And we have four national training sessions a year. And we do one here in Washington, D.C., and we do one in Denver, and then we do two in the mountains of Denver.
That's where y'all got the name Mile High?
Yes,
okay.
Because it started just kind of like California Pizza Kitchen, you know, we have here in Washington, D.C., but they started in California.
Now, do people pay to attend these things?
Now, it's part of their franchise training.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, they're a franchise, and just like, you know, Subway or California Pizza Kitchen, they're going to have their owners of their franchises come in for training. And we have a thing called Mile High University where they come in and learn all the ABCs of how to run a martial arts school, from, you know, marketing all the way to, you know, retention and testing and everything, you know, all the nuts and bolts of how to run an operation.
That's awesome. Well, if somebody wanted to get a hold of you or possibly ask you information about training with you at your gym up in Virginia, or possibly inquiring about this organization you're talking about, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about how to contact you and everything else?
Probably the best way is, you know, the internet is so universal now. Email is much better than snail mail, and that's probably the best way. And my email address is World Champion Jeff Smith Karate at AOL.com. And if you put WCJS Karate, that way you don't have to spell out the world champion, Jeff Smith. You just put WCJS and then karate at AOL.com.
Do you have a website also?
Yes, and they can go to jeffsmithkarate.com. They can go to milehighkarate.com.
And that's it? Is that all you have as far as access to get a hold of you? What about a phone number? Do you have a business line or anything?
Yeah, they can call the school, and that's a 703 area code for Virginia, and then 444-2488. 444-2488.
Okay,
so that goes right into the school.
Cool. Well, listen, Jeff, this has been a great interview, and I'm very honored that you decided to actually do a show with me. And I'll get this thing edited, and I'll try to have it on the air on Sunday. And so that'd be when your show's going to be aired. You have when we get off the air here, I'm going to ask you a little bit about how to get a hold of some cool photographs of you to put on the website for the show and everything else.
Okay.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell anybody out there?
Nope. Just glad to get a chance to talk to you. I heard your interview with Pat Burleson and Alan Steen, and I was very impressed with it was very informative, and I think for anybody who's interested in the history of martial arts and trying to find their roots and where everything came from, that you're doing a great service for everybody out there to expand and really get a lot of tales and a lot of information and stuff that black belts and martial arts students love to hear about some of the people that they used to read about or see in the magazines or on TV in any of the competitions or have heard about, and get a chance to find out some background in-depth stuff that is very informative. I found out stuff about Alan Steen and Pat Burleson that I didn't know. That
right.
I listened to the whole thing. It was a great, great interview.
Well, one of the motivations that I had is because of MMA and some of the progressive ways that karate has evolved away from competition and more into your inner school stuff. You always hear people that are trying to undermine karate. They say, well, that's just karate. I said, and then they try to pretend that, you can't fight or you don't fight. And I tell everybody, I said, you don't want any of this. You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And you're thinking about maybe a neighborhood commercial karate school that teaches mainly kids and that doesn't compete in tournaments, because the system that I came from and all the black belts that I trained with above and below me, it's some rough stuff. In other words, you have to really know how to fight.
Exactly. And next time, we'll maybe do a follow-up on this, and we can cover a little bit about how I fought in one of the first MMA championships that they ever had back in 75 in Hawaii.
Oh, really?
At it was called Tommy Lee. Tommy Lee was the promoter. Now, there's another Tommy Lee that lives in Maryland, but not him. There was a guy from Hawaii named
right.
Tommy Lee, and he did the first he called it the World Series of Martial Arts.
Oh, I remember that.
And Benny fought in the very first one, and then 3 months later, Benny won the first one, and 3 months later, I fought in the next one, and Joe Louis fought in it also. Joe Louis lost in the championships in the heavyweight division to a boxer from Hawaii named Teddy Lemos, and I won the light heavyweight division, but it was knees and elbows and pins and takedowns and throws and joint locking, anything you wanted. It was a no holds bar, and all styles, even street fighters could get into it if they wanted, and it was a whole elimination thing that went all the way down to a final championship in four weight classes. Their first one they did that was 3 months before, they didn't have weight class, and they didn't have as many people in it.
Right.
And then this next time, he did weight classes, and that opened it up for a lot of people. And those kind of events and things a lot of people don't know about.
Well, karate has always evolved, and Bruce Lee had a lot to do with that. And as far as, if the technique works, then we're going to try it. And you mentioned that earlier in the show about if somebody threw a technique into work, and plus you guys influenced me on some of my techniques by coming down here and fighting in the U.S. championships, and some of the flashy stuff. And so I was I was like I'm fortunate to have come up in karate from 1972 and to been around long enough to know all you guys. And so that was a lot of my motivation also, is like, you have no idea how much talent has been out there, and you guys wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for these guys. Because these are the guys that did all the experimenting, not only in business, but in competition, the various types of competition, and from the point karate to the full contact karate, and also the event that you just mentioned, that type of style of fighting, and some of the innovations that y'all did in business also. Yeah. They were always top-notch and always cutting-edge. Y'all never did really copy anybody. Y'all always kind of did your own thing. And so whatever we know or do today came from what you guys did.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Jeff, I appreciate you having you on the show. We're going to take a little break here, and I'm going to play some more music for everybody. This is Jeff Overturf with WTFRadio.me and Jeff Smith. Okay, this song is called "Why Can't You Love Me" by Chris Watson.
Why can't you love me no more?